Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. And today we had a super interesting conversation. We had Dr. Charles Nemiroff. He's the co-director of the Center for Psychedelic Research at UT Austin, here in Austin, where we are. And he basically is an expert in psychedelic therapy and has also experience in the intersection between psychological diseases, mental health, and chronic diseases, such as the ones we deal with in the cardiovascular space. So we had a super interesting conversation, kind of deep dive into the possible benefits of psychedelics in our patients and how it can assist us to provide better care, definitely in the future.
That's very interesting, really eye-opening. So yeah. Tune in.
Vamos.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. Today we have Dr. Charles Nemiroff. And Dr. Nemiroff is a full professor here at UT Austin and works in the Center for Psychedelic Research. He's the director of the Center for Psychedelic Research, and he has an interest in the intersection between psychiatry, psychedelic research, and chronic conditions like we're interested in, such as you know, vascular health, cardiovascular pathologies, and how those two fields mix and interact. So welcome. Thank you for spending a little bit of your time. I know you have a lot of work to do. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Likewise. Charles, one of the things that I think about this is what career path gets you to be leading a psychedelic research unit, because that doesn't seem to be like something you should go to college and say, hey, this is the path I want to have. So how'd you get into this? It's very intriguing, very exciting, but how do you get to this leadership position?
Well, let me give you the glib answer first, which is you guys are too young to remember this, but I was at Woodstock.
Yeah.
So I witnessed a lot of this firsthand back in the late 60s. And early 70s.
I'm very jealous, by the way. That is one of those memorable things that,
I know.
If I was alive then,
I would have gone too.
I would have sown to be there.
Yeah.
I would have been there with you.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. It really was. So, my entire career really has been focused on research using the most stringent scientific rigor in looking at either pathophysiology of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or other disorders, and in particular, looking at novel treatments. And in psychiatry over the last 20 years, we've developed a number of new treatments that have been FDA approved for the treatment of one or another of these disorders. And those, of course, as you both know, are conducted by randomized controlled clinical trials, and that the FDA has a certain bar that you have to cross in order to get a new treatment approved. Having said that, although our treatments are quite good, we have no way to predict in a given patient who will respond to a given treatment. So personalized medicine in psychiatry is not the way it is in oncology, where you could match patients' tumor type to a particular chemotherapy. So that's one great need that we have. If a patient comes to see me who has clearly major depression, and I have 25 different choices of medications, of different mechanisms of action, I'm not able a priori to determine which would be the best fit for that patient. We have a couple of clues, but by and large, it's trial and error. So that's one problem we have in the field. The second is that a substantial minority of patients do not respond to conventional treatments. So you run through the usual algorithm of, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, antidepressants, and then you use others like bupropion or mirtazapine or even the old MAO inhibitors. But there are a group of patients with major depression, with post-traumatic stress disorder, that just don't respond, or even to evidence-based psychotherapies. And so those patients are at the greatest risk for suicide. And as it turns out, they're also at the greatest risk for cardiovascular disease, which we could talk about if we have time. So research on new agents to treat depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and related disorders is a really important unmet need. And so in the 1950s, psychedelics were used by folks like Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who were investigators at Harvard, and they ended up suggesting that psychedelics may have a role in combining with psychotherapy to help people overcome one or another malady. And then things got a bit out of hand, and psychedelics, they became somewhat of a group of zealots, and they fundamentally said, drop out, turn on, psychedelics is the answer to a new spiritual life. And at the time, the president of the United States was Richard Nixon. He didn't exactly embrace this philosophy. And so psychedelics were classified as Schedule I drugs. And as you know, Schedule I drugs like heroin are fundamentally unable to be studied in any research arena, and certainly not able to be prescribed. And so from the early 1970s until about 5 years ago, we couldn't do any funded research to determine whether there may be a role for psychedelics. And so a group in the UK started publishing papers of studies they had done with psilocybin, suggesting that psilocybin had a beneficial role in patients who had failed other treatments for depression. And that sort of snowballed, and partly because of a great deal of pressure from the masses about psychedelics, the FDA and the law enforcement authorities started relaxing the restrictions about doing psychedelic research. And two companies sort of stepped up. One company is called Compass Pathways, and they're studying psilocybin and depression and other disorders. Another is called MAPS. And they are studying a psychedelic MDMA in post-traumatic stress disorder. And so a number of factors conspired to result in an avalanche of interest in psychedelics. So part of it is that some states have legalized psychedelics, Oregon in particular, but California to follow, so that there will be widespread availability of psychedelics, like it or not. And so there are a number of questions that we need to address. And I apologize for lecturing you. I don't mean to do that.
No, please.
But just to give you a little background, the fundamental questions that we need to ask is, number one, there's a difference between the use of psychedelics if you have no psychiatric disorder and you want to use psychedelics to help you investigate your spiritual self. And that's what psychedelics were used for centuries in various civilizations. A totally separate issue is whether psychedelics can actually treat difficult to treat psychiatric disorders. And so circling back to the question you asked me, you know, over the last 30 years, the population I've studied the most in my NIH-funded research are individuals with depression or post-traumatic stress disorder who have a history of child abuse and neglect. And those individuals have the poorest response to conventional antidepressant treatment, both medication or psychotherapy. As an aside of interest to you, is they also have the highest risk for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, drug abuse, suicide, etc. So it was that population that sort of got me interested in psychedelics. And then secondly, and maybe even more importantly, I was concerned about the widespread availability of psychedelics because of their propensity to result in very serious adverse side effects. So these are very, very powerful drugs.
What side effects would these be?
You know, they have both cardiovascular side effects acutely, but they can have psychiatric side effects in the long run. So I wanted to provide some scientific rigor to the psychedelic field. And that's a very long-winded answer to your question.
Is there, and by all means, this is exactly the forum where long-winded explanations are welcomed. You have I want to say probably cardiovascular physicians in their 30s, 40s, and early 50s, and a lot of the people that's around the business around it. That's who is here, and I think that inevitably there's a lot of us that at some point in time have been exposed to these and so understand it and are very tickled by the potential goodness that a lot of these medications can bring. And so I think that the context that you provided as to where we're at, what has happened and what we're trying to do, I think it's very needed. Here's a follow-up question though. Is there an easy answer or a short answer to what is the unmet need with current psychiatric medications that psychedelics could probably provide? And I'm talking about it potentially maybe at a pharmacological basis. Like, how we recognize this one big gap that all these other medications like serotonin inhibitors and, you know, cannot do or do in a bad way, that somehow psychedelics could be the champions in this field?
Yeah, that's a fabulous question. So I'll just present the data to you. In the largest study ever done to look at the efficacy of antidepressants, which was called the STAR-D study, about 2,400 patients were treated with an SSRI, citalopram, Celexa. And the shocking result in an open fashion was that only 28% of those patients got into remission, meaning they were fundamentally asymptomatic. Now, the remainder of the study switched them to other agents, and more patients eventually got into remission. But the bottom line is the response to initial monotherapy with antidepressants is less efficacious than we had hoped.
Okay.
So there is a really big unmet need, and there is a hardcore group of patients who simply don't respond to conventional FDA-approved treatments. Now, having said that, there have been some non-psychedelic advances in the field recently that are very exciting. There's a neuromodulation strategy using what's called transcranial magnetic stimulation which provides a direct magnetic stimulation of left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and if done in a very intense way, can actually result in remission in patients that are very treatment refractory. But, you know, having said that, relatively, you know, few studies have been done in this area. So it leads to the question of what is the current data about the efficacy of psychedelics? And as I mentioned, there are these two companies that are moving along towards FDA submission. The MAPS company, which has a new name, which I can't remember, has submitted to the FDA for approval of MDMA coupled with psychotherapy for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. They have published three randomized clinical trials that show efficacy in PTSD, and the magnitude of the effect is large. Now, having said that, understand that you can't really be blinded in a psychedelic study. Yeah. And the gold standard, of course, in all studies, including those that you're involved in cardiovascular disease, is that they're double-blinded studies. The patient shouldn't know what they're getting, and the rater or the investigator shouldn't know. Well, that's impossible with psychedelics, right? Because the patients obviously know what they're getting, and the investigators who are sitting with them during this 6 to 8 hour experience can tell that, you know, to use a lay term, they're tripping, right? So that really that's a serious obstacle. You know, how do you get around this?
Doctor, one of the natural question at this point is, do you have to trip, right? I mean, if you give me enough beta blockers, I'm going to be on the ground with you know, very low, you know, if you give me enough atropine, I'm going to be on the ground with the bradycardia.
Yeah.
That just shows that probably I could sense the effect of the medication. So are there micro doses that could potentially not be noticeable in the form of a 6 hour trip, but that could still have a long lasting effect and that could potentially go through the rigor of double blinded studies?
And can you, I think to answer that, what is your insight into the mechanism of action of these group of substances?
Well, you both asked two very big questions. Let me start with the first one. So you're very astute in raising the question about microdosing, because if you could do a study with microdosing, you would obviate the double-blind placebo confound. And there are a number of companies, startup companies, that are looking at microdosing. And there are a gazillion case reports in the social media about people that are microdosing. And Michael Pollan wrote a book about how LSD microdosing had changed his life. Having said that, there's not yet a single randomized double-blind trial with psychedelics using microdosing.
Okay.
I personally think that has a reasonable chance of success for a lot of reasons. There are companies that are combining psychedelic with an anti-inflammatory agent, because a whole nother topic is that about 25% of patients with depression actually have an increase in inflammatory markers. So the bottom line is, I think it's a fabulous idea. We should get the results within the next year of a psilocybin low-dose study. I will say, in the acute studies in which doses of 1, 10, and 25 milligrams of psilocybin were compared, the 1 milligram dose, which didn't have any noticeable effect, at least acutely, had no noticeable clinical benefit.
Okay.
And so one of the debates going on in the field right now, very hotly debated, is the psychedelic experience necessary for the therapeutic benefit?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the answer. The other question has to do with the mechanism of action of psychedelics. So all psychedelics thus far studied are agonists at the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor. And so that's been the dogma, you know, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, ayahuasca, all of them are agonists at the 5-HT2A receptor. And there's a fair amount of animal data that would suggest that if you block that receptor, you could block the effects of psychedelics. Having said that, there's a single case report, very interesting case of a patient in Toronto who took part in a psilocybin trial. And, you know, he fundamentally, you know, signed the informed consent and said that he was taking no other medication. And he was very seriously depressed. And he took the psilocybin and remarkably did not have a psychedelic experience at all. Mm. But he stayed in the trial and he had a therapeutic response in terms of his depression. He later revealed that he was taking trazodone to help himself sleep, which is a serotonin 2A receptor antagonist. So in this single case, it suggested that maybe you can get a therapeutic benefit and it has nothing to do with the 5-HT2A receptor.
That's very interesting.
There are also a number of brain imaging studies done, and it won't surprise you that psychedelics change the activity of a number of brain regions. You know, which of those mediate the therapeutic effects, if any, and we really haven't talked much about the magnitude of the therapeutic effect. But these are active avenues of investigation. The good news is the National Institutes of Health are now finally funding research on psychedelics.
Dr. Nemiroff, one of kind of the selfish reasons I wanted to bring you on the podcast is that, you know, especially in the clinic setting, I find it very frustrating trying to get patients to change habits that bring them to me and that make my surgeries fail, which is smoking, diabetes. Could you envision a time where I am in my clinic and I have a patient that is trying to quit smoking, and, you know, says, you know, stress comes in my life and I resort back to smoking, where I could just put a referral to your clinic? It's like, okay, go to Dr. Nemiroff and his team to address this issue. Is that something that's in my future as a practitioner?
I love your question. So if I was a betting person, I would say absolutely yes. And I'll explain to you why. So you and I deal with patients who fundamentally are in a rut. They get into what I call the circle of hell. And you can think about this in terms of drug and alcohol abuse in particular. I don't really want to drink. I'm not going to drink today. I'm really going to stay sober. No, I guess I'll have one drink or maybe two or three. The same with cigarette smoking. The same with opiate addiction. And just to broaden it a bit, there are disorders in the psychiatric realm that are also characterized by this compulsive behaviors that are absolutely abominable for your health. Anorexia or nervosa, for example, comes to mind, where these patients just can't bring themselves to eat. So there are some initial studies, small studies, in alcohol abuse, in nicotine dependence, and even an open study in anorexia. And so I think what psychedelics do is they're sort of like a cerebral catharsis. You know, I think fundamentally they break you out of the circuit of hell that your neurons are in and allow you to form alternate connections. And this is the whole concept of neuroplasticity. Fundamentally, the brain imaging studies, for whatever they're worth, has shown that in the aftermath of psychedelics, brain regions that normally don't talk much to each other do so more. And those brain regions that are sort of like routinely connected all the time do so a little less. And so I think the short answer to your question is, yeah, I believe that a lot of the patients you see are engaging in unhealthy behaviors. And I, honestly, Alan, I've had patients Afghanistan veterans who've come back from Afghanistan who are drinking, you know, a fifth to a gallon of scotch a day, and who can't stop and are, at the very least, being verbally abusive to their spouse and not being a good father, and are just miserable and angry, who have gone to Costa Rica and had a psychedelic experience and have literally said to me, I've lost the taste for alcohol. Right? So I think there is a lot of benefit here. I do feel compelled, though, to say that there is another side of psychedelics, which is, and it's important that everybody understands this, what psychedelics fundamentally do is they tear away an individual's defense mechanisms. So normally, you know, you and I are going through life and we have a certain amount of intact ego, and we think of ourselves as competent and basically good people, and we don't think about things that are very unpleasant. We don't want to think about the fact that, you know, we're mortal. We don't like to think about the fact that the world can be a dangerous place. And we certainly don't like to think about past life events in which we might have been better people. And then you take a psychedelic and it rips away all of those defenses. And the term we used to use from an old novel, it's like naked lunch. Suddenly you're confronted with who you are, what you look like, and you know, what's your relationship with your parents, with your children, with your colleagues. And for some people, as you would imagine, that's a terrifying and difficult experience. If you have a propensity for a psychiatric disorder, if you have a loaded family history for bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, and you've never had any psychiatric symptoms, a psychedelic could propel you into a psychotic episode. And I published a case report about one of my patients that had that experience last year. And then, because you're cardiac guys, I should say, the experience itself is associated with a very significant increase in heart rate and blood pressure. And one of my concerns is that in Oregon, the legalization of psilocybin is demedicalized. It does not require any medical screening or oversight. Fundamentally, and you know, you guys may know this, but think about this. You go to the mushroom store.
It's next to the vape shop. Yeah.
Oh, I think you need about 3 grams based on your size. We won't even mention the fact that psychedelic content varies from mushroom to mushroom. Then you go to the person who is going to bring you through this experience. They've gone through 40 hours of internet training. They don't need to have any professional degree. And you don't need any medical screening. So, there are going to be people that are at risk for cardiac events, and bad things are going to happen. So, you know, I'm concerned about that.
Is there enough scientific rigor at this point to consider that one episode, meaning one exposure, can be enough to get over some event, and or on the other hand, is it better to have a more linear and more structured exposure, with or without the medical direction? Yeah, I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying that people should fly to the middle of the jungle in Brazil and have a shaman take him on some weird, you know, trip and absolutely no guardrails. But is it under medical supervision? Is one episode possibly enough to get through a problem that is significantly bogging us down?
That's a great question. So I can just tell you what the data are. So the best data that speaks to your specific question are in patients with metastatic disease who are suffering with depression and anxiety. In a single treatment with psilocybin has been shown to have very long-lasting benefit on depression and anxiety. So these are end-of-life people with metastatic disease, and there's benefit 6 months out after a single experience.
After a single experience. That's incredible. Is this, are you alluding to the Hopkins, to the Johns Hopkins study in this?
Yeah, this was the Hopkins study. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's very incredible. And I mean, I think I've heard this, and I forget who referenced it, but it was something like one experience with psilocybin equals 100 therapy sessions, something like that.
I think that was Michael Pollan.
It's interesting you say that. So we just published a commentary in the American Journal of Psychiatry where we questioned the term psychedelic assisted therapy. That's the term that has been adopted because it implies that the juice here is the therapy and that psychedelics are assisting its efficacy. And our argument was, no, it's the drug that's making the difference. Because in the patients that, for example, were randomized to a high dose of psilocybin versus a low dose, the patients who got the low dose got therapy too, and they didn't get better. Mm-hmm. So we think the secret sauce is the psychedelic itself. Now, having said that, in the last publication of the psilocybin trial that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and these were treatment-resistant depressed patients, the results were statistically significant, but they were relatively modest, right? It wasn't like they had a 50% remission rate in the patients that had been treatment-resistant and then had the two sessions with psilocybin. So the remission rate was more like, I don't know exactly, maybe 20%, maybe slightly less. But having said that, if you're that patient, that's very meaningful.
What's the process of, after you have the psychedelic experience, how do you guide patients to, take this experience and get the best out of it? Do you have to do anything? Like you just maybe implied that you don't, or is there something that maximizes the effect, some sort of, guidance therapy, however you may want to name it, after that you think will benefit the patient?
So up until now, the process in the clinical trials has been, once the patients have passed the screen and they have sufficient depression severity, and as an aside, you know that the population in a clinical trial is very different than the population in your clinic.
Yeah.
So how generalizable these findings will be for people with more mild depression, for example, you can be chronically depressed, but not severe. And we don't know, what these medications might or might not be useful in that realm. So, but you get screened, the patients get screened, and then they go through what's called psychoeducation. They receive a lot of information from the research assistants and the psychologists as to the nature of your depression, and then here's what you would expect to have in terms of experience during the dosing. And what we do and what all reputable centers do is there are two people with the patient at all times, usually a male and a female. And this has to do with safety. And unfortunately, there have been incredibly untoward events in which subjects at other centers were taken advantage of during the psychedelic experience, which is horrific. So fundamentally, the patients are put into a room. It's a very, the room is very standardized. It has a couch, a couple of chairs, dim lighting. You get to pick your playlist out beforehand. You have eye shades on and headphones.
Why do you do music and eye shades? Is that any reason?
Because one of the things that psychedelics do is it markedly increases your sensitivity to light and sound. And you know, right now you're sitting in a room, you're talking to me, but there's a curtain behind you and there's some objects on the table. And the microphone is right near your face, and you're being bombarded with stimuli. But you, not being under the influence of a psychedelic, you could focus, you could ignore all of those other things, and you could focus on our conversation. When you take a psychedelic, you lose that filter, and you're suddenly bombarded with, you know, the fabric of the curtain and the color of the curtain. And you're also seeing, visual and auditory distortions. And so what the eye shades and the headphones do is it helps to sort of ground you and prevent you from getting overwhelmed. You know, when people ask me about what music to pick, I say, I think it would be better to listen to Vivaldi than it would be to listen to the Grateful Dead or Led Zeppelin, right? But people choose whatever they choose. So they go through this generally about 6 hours of the experience. Some patients get frightened and they want to hold the hand of the research assistants that are with them. That's okay. And they provide reassurance. And then after the experience, the subjects are taken home by a family member. And then they come back the next day and they go through what's called integration, which is a very open-ended conversation, you know, where I'd say, you know, Alan, what was it like for you? And you'd say, you know, I saw my dead grandmother. Really? Well, how did it feel? Well, I was just thinking about how much I missed her, and I was thinking about how I wished I had spent more time with her. I'd say, is that something you would think about prior to the psychedelic experience? And you would say, you know, actually, I haven't thought about it in a long time. So you go through this integration experience, and you cover all of the emotional and cognitive kinds of experiences they had. And generally, the subjects want to talk about it a lot. But this is not psychotherapy as we know it, right? This is not evidence-based psychotherapy used to treat depression or PTSD. This is very open-ended sort of integration. And so the patients go through this a few times, depending on what the protocol is. Over the next, it could be once a week for the next 3 weeks, et cetera, et cetera. And then they're followed, depending on the protocol, for up to a year after the experience. Some of the protocols have two or even three doses spread apart, like once a week for 3 weeks, which is what the MDMA protocol was for PTSD. And in that protocol, there is a manual to actually exactly how the psychologist should conduct their interactions with the patients.
So do you think, let me ask you a bit of a of an ethical question tying in something from the past. If we continue doing research, and it seems like this is remarkable, right? By all, you know, very, very early signs, but everything seems to point that there's something here of great potential and value for civilization. We have, in a way, been critical of the dude that sells you a bag somewhere in the middle of nowhere with no guardrails. But if it is this good, should it be essentially kept from the general public and allow the psychiatrists to be essentially the bouncers to a potentially disruptive therapy that, by the way, is going to be just a few of them that believe in it, and all of them are going to try to just stick you with Prozac and alprazolam ahead of ever giving you the opportunity to getting to that? So it just seems like there's a lot of layers of complexity in this journey to allow people that really could benefit from this to get into an appropriate, safe, you know, safe system where you can get it. Whereas in a way I'm like, well, I kind of feel like maybe this more, you know, anarchy and chaotic way of allowing some of the people to get it to may not be a crazy idea here. What do you think, Charles?
Yeah, it's a great question. So let me sort of back up and just say that you, with the three of us, as physicians, live in a world in which we prescribe medications that are approved by the FDA, and then third-party payers refuse to authorize it.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And we go through this painful process where we're talking to a moron.
Correct.
At the other end of the line.
Yes,
he's usually a retired orthopedic surgeon. Yeah. Who doesn't know anything about psychiatry or cardiovascular medicine.
Yeah.
So I think we need to put that question into the context of the problem with availability. And honestly, there's no field that's worse in this regard than oncology. And, you know, we diagnose people with lung cancer and they have the marker for the biomarker for a wonderful immune treatment. And then we can't get, because they don't have insurance, they're not going to get it. So we have a problem in general. And this is going to rear its ugly head in this field. So the question that you're asking, I'll just tell you point blank in my conversations with psychedelic companies, they plan on charging something like between $10,000 and $20,000 for a treat.
Wow.
And whether that will include the psychology part or not is unclear. But the bottom line is, in order for them to recoup their investment, which is substantial, as you would imagine. And so that raises the question of who's going to pay for it. Now, the PTSD field has an advantage in that the VA is a powerful lobbying force. And I think it's likely, I'm just this conjecture, I think it's likely that using the power of the VA and the fact that both state and federal legislators are generally pro a veteran, I suspect that when MDMA is approved for the treatment of PTSD, there will be a substantial push to get this reimbursed by third-party payers. And, you know, as you know, this is a huge problem in all of medicine.
Yeah.
So, and I suspect the psilocybin will be, I don't know how it'll be priced. And so the question you're raising is, why would I pay $20,000 for two doses of psilocybin when I can go to Oregon and get my 3 grams of mushrooms and have somebody administer it to me? And I think that's a very legitimate question. My biggest concern is if there are a slew of adverse events, it could propel us back to the Nixonian era. You know, if I'm just going to make this up, but if a patient took, say, 5 grams of psilocybin and decided they could fly and jumped off a building, that would not be good for them or the field.
And I think we saw that with the whole Matthew Perry thing where he was, I think, doing ketamine assisted therapy and drowned, apparently on ketamine. So, you know, if we see a couple more celebrities, you know, maybe jump off a building, then it's going to be an issue.
It's kind of like also a rather ironic point in this country, because the death toll from alcohol related tobacco related issues has made us flinch in no way whatsoever as to potentially you know, I would rather a world where marijuana was readily available and liquor was much more limited. Like, I think we would be much more healthy as a society.
I couldn't agree with you more. Although, you know, there are, you know, there's pretty good data now that you know, the prevalence rate of schizophrenia in the world, all worldwide, is 1%. But if you're exposed to cannabis as an adolescent, your risk goes up to 4%.
Oh, I didn't know this statistic. That's, you know, that's interesting. That's
substantial. So, you know, again, we need to know who's at risk for various disorders. But in general, in my clinical practice, I can't begin to tell you how many patients' lives have been destroyed by alcohol. Without a doubt. The other issue is, you know, as you know, we're in the midst of this fentanyl epidemic. And, you know, how many of the patients I see have said to me, oh, you know, I know what I'm getting from this guy. He's a good guy. And I go, well, you know, you really don't know what you're getting.
Yeah, he's a certified dealer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's that and blue check mark.
Xanax that you buy on the street is laced with fentanyl.
Yeah. Is there any role for psychedelics in the well individual? Is there any role for, you know, us as...
You mean as recreational?
No, as, you know, a way to integrate, you know, a high-stress job, high-stress life. You know, is there any benefit for those type of individuals?
So my one of my mentors when I was in residency actually said to me one day that what psychedelics were going to be used for would be to allow indigent patients to go on vacation. That literally they were going to take a trip. They couldn't afford to go to Hawaii or Jamaica, but they could stay in their home and the whole panoply, right, would be available to
them. That is so dark.
So I think, you know, as I said before, I think there are totally individuals that do not suffer with any psychiatric disorder who would enjoy the benefits of a psychedelic experience. Having said that, I'll also say that at least in my experience, there's certain personality traits that would augur for a poor experience. So individuals who are incredibly control freaks, who have tremendous egos, including, you know, narcissism, who are not introspective in any way, I suspect, at least in my experience, they don't do well with psychedelics.
I mean, I have
a lot of surgeons.
I know firsthand, I believe, of somebody that had some background, some history in his family. And it was an episode of psychedelics that unleashed a bipolar. Event.
That's what happened to my patient that I published this case report on.
This
was a young woman in her 30s living in LA, working for a great firm, and she fundamentally had never done any illicit drugs of any kind, and she ended up getting peer group pressured into taking psilocybin. Had a great experience, decided to do it again the next day, and then had a horrendous manic psychotic episode with paranoid delusions, followed by a severe depression. And it literally took about 8 months to get her back to where she was.
Wow. Everything in moderation, including moderation.
Not even moderation, but with science, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I think what you're doing here is tremendous. We are sort of kind of getting to the end of the time that we asked you to carve, but I want to congratulate you on putting into perspective and creating enough depth of knowledge to understand who, how, when these things can become powerful tools for the care of our patients and ourselves, to be, you know, quite frank, in a world where mental health continues to grow in staggering ways, we need this. And if there's anything we can do to support you, I would also love to foresee the future where I could refer back and forth and this just be the norm.
Yeah.
The norm.
Yeah. And yeah, I want to really admire the rigorousness with which you're, you know, taking this endeavor. I think that's definitely needed. And yeah, congratulate you on that too. And I really appreciate that you took some time. I can't imagine how busy you are to speak with us. It means a lot. And hopefully, you know, everyone takes something out of this conversation.
Well, you guys are easy to talk to. And you asked the right questions. You obviously did a lot of homework. So I appreciate that. Yeah. And I hope our paths cross again soon.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a practical question. If any of our audience out there either has a patient or themselves interested in getting in touch with you or in understanding more about some of the research projects and potentially be involved, what is the best way to learn more about what you're doing? Is there a web page? Is there an email or a phone number that, you know, people can reach and get more information on?
Yeah. So, we do have the Center for Psychedelic Research and Therapy has a webpage,
okay,
which has the phone numbers. We are recruiting currently into clinical trials for people who have failed other antidepressant treatments.
Okay.
We're also recruiting into a study for anorexia nervosa. So you can always send me an email.
What we normally do is we have notes for every one of these podcasts. So we are going to put the webpage in a hyperlink so people can go there. I do think it's very important for everybody out there to understand that this is actively enrolling, because I bet you there's going to be more than one person that says, you know what, I've got a patient,
yeah,
or I've got a family member, or I'm going to go myself. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody does spike some interest. So, Doctor, thank you for your time. It is a Saturday. We want to return it to you and your family. And know that you have a house and a home here at A Life Afloat. If you ever want to come and talk to us again about any exciting projects, just let us know.
It'll be a pleasure.
We'd love to hear you again.
Yeah, you let me know. Thank
All right.
you, guys.
You have a beautiful day. Bye-bye. Thank you.